It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Do you remember the first novel you fell in love with? Jane Eyre, maybe, or Crime and Punishment, or The Color Purple. A great novel can crack your heart open. It can introduce you to a whole new world. But can it also make you a more moral or compassionate person? In this hour, does fiction make us good? Well, that's a question the acclaimed British writer Ian McEwan has thought about.
One thing that novels do, I think, better than any other art form is to give us some idea of what it's like to be someone else. I think that is fundamentally moral. I mean, I think an act of cruelty is ultimately a failure of imagination. If you knew what it was like to be someone else, you couldn't be cruel to them. And I think empathy is at the basis of our moral interaction.
So we all love the feeling of getting lost in a good story, seeing the world through a character's eyes. But recently, psychologists have gotten interested in the question of whether that experience actually changes readers. Novelist and psychologist Keith Oatley is the author of Such Stuff as Dreams, The Psychology of Fiction. He tells Steve Paulson how reading literature can help you be more empathetic.
Keith, a lot of your research looks at how fiction might be good for us, but is there anything wrong with reading just because we enjoy it?
Well, no, I think probably that's the best way. But teachers like to know, for instance, that what people are doing when they're reading for leisure is good for them, and I think it's probably good for all of us to know.
Now, in the past few years, you and some other researchers have found that reading fiction actually increases our empathy. Why would that be the case?
Probably the main reason is that although in ordinary language we think of fiction as something that has been made up, really that's not very helpful. The right way to think about fiction is it's about us human beings and what we are up to with each other. And so if you read a lot of it, then you're enabled to think about that a lot. And you actually get better at understanding other people and what's going on among them. So really what fiction is a set of alternative worlds, model worlds, if you like, into which we can enter and we can both meet people and we can be different people. And if we spend a lot of time doing that, we actually get better at some of the things that are necessary for social interaction.
Now, isn't what you're talking about what scholars have called theory of mind? I mean, basically sort of trying to get in the heads of other people and to have some understanding of what they're thinking?
Yes, absolutely. That's the psychologist's technical term for this theory of mind. That's to say having a theory or an understanding of another person who you could be interacting with or who you're interested in. And so what happens when you're reading fiction is that these processes of, as it were, exercising your theory of mind are called into play.
Now, what you're saying makes sense to me, but I'm wondering how you actually test this in a scientific way.
Well, in our department, there was a guy called Keith Stanovich, and he had a very good idea about measuring the amount of reading people have done in their lives. So what we did is Raymond Marr. Raymond was a graduate student at the time. So we had a measure of the amount of fiction people read during their lives and the amount of nonfiction that they read. And then we gave them two tests of social understanding. One of them involves looking at 36 pictures of people's eyes, as if you're looking at them through a letterbox, and saying what that person is thinking or feeling. And it turns out that the more fiction reading people did, then the better they were at this test. It's called the mind in the eyes test. And it tests empathy and understanding of other people. And it's been used very widely and effectively. So it's a well-established test.
Wait, so are you saying that people who read fiction tend to be more empathic, but reading nonfiction does not have that effect?
That's what we find. Now, you shouldn't think of it as that being bad. So if you read about astronomy, then what you get better at is astronomy. If you read about genetics, you get better at genetics. So people who read a lot of fiction do spend many hours doing it, and it's largely because of the subject matter. The subject matter is social interaction, people, what they're up to with each other, what would happen in this circumstance, what would happen in that.
Okay, so you're saying that that reading fiction can increase our capacity for empathy. Is that to say that reading fiction actually makes us better people? That we become more moral as a result?
It isn't that reading makes you better at understanding people, and it also doesn't make you a more moral person. What it does enable you to do, though, is if these are issues that are of interest to you, reading fiction enables you to go in that direction. Now, there is a researcher called Dan Johnson who has shown that reading a piece of fiction did indeed increase empathy, and then that did indeed increase the amount of helping of another person.
Of course, there's a classic counterexample, the Nazis. And we know that many Nazis were great lovers of literature, of art, and German culture at that time was among the most sophisticated and cosmopolitan in the world, and yet they were killers. As the literary critic George Steiner once wrote, "We know that a man can read Goethe or Rilke in the evening, that he can play Bach and Schubert, and go to his day's job at Auschwitz in the morning." What do you make of that?
Well, I think that's another very interesting question. I think Steiner is overdoing it a bit when he said that these were educated people and that education then hadn't stopped them being terrible. What actually happened, I think, is that most of the stories that were circulating in Nazi Germany from 1933 onwards were about Germany being great, about nationalism, about being able to be proud of yourself, and so on and so on. And a lot of people took that story on board, or that set of stories. And so I think they were dominant then as compared with reading Goethe.
You're raising a fascinating question here. I mean, the suggestion is maybe if you read the wrong stuff, maybe if you read bad stories, or going back to fiction, if you read novels with reprehensible characters and you identify with them, if you actually sympathize with them, maybe that makes you a worse person.
Well, I worry about that. I think it's like choosing friends. You need to be careful what friends you choose and who you hang out with. And I think you need to be careful what you read as well.
Really? So there is, I mean, you think there probably is harmful fiction out there.
Oh, yes. Katrina Fong has done a study looking at different kinds of fiction, looking at romance, family stories, thrillers, and science fiction. And she's found that the kind of fiction that has the best kind of effect on understanding others is, guess what? Romance. And when you think about it, you see, an awful lot of romance stories are about understanding that other person to know whether really you want to be with them. Science fiction, on the other hand, didn't have any effect of enabling us to understand other people, and that's because an awful lot of it, you know, is about whether you can travel at, you know, three times the speed of light or something like that. And so if you spend a lot of time doing a particular kind of thing, then you do get better at that. So a person who spends a lot of time, let's say, reading very violent stories probably becomes more preoccupied with violence. I can imagine that that would be the case.
We've been talking about books in terms of increasing our empathy. What about watching movies, watching television? Do the same principles apply?
I think all the things that we've just been talking about still hold. There are wonderful artistic films. And my colleague Raymond has done a study with preschool children. And what they did was to measure the amount of stories that the children had read to them, measure the number of films, movies that they watched, and measure the amount of television, general television, that they watched. So the more stories they had read to them and the more films they watched, then the better they were on five measures of theory of mind. Television didn't have any effect.
Really? I mean, I guess it depends on what kind of television you watch. I mean, there's some very good television out there.
There's some very good television out there. But if you're a kid, for instance, five-year-olds aren't particularly good at being able to tell the difference between the program and the advertisements, right? And stories have structure and invite you to enter into these model worlds. And that's probably an important issue. So films and television series that do that, then I would expect they would have exactly the same kind of effects that we found for reading fiction.
So what do you think is actually going on in our brains when we're reading a good story? I mean, when we are relating to a character in the novel?
It turns out that the part of the brain that you use for understanding a story is also part of the brain that's used for understanding other people.
Now, we're talking about the way our brains respond to stories. And I guess I have an even deeper question, which is why we seem to want to tell stories in the first place, why we want to hear stories. Is there an evolutionary explanation?
I think the way we would think about that is that really what stories are is that they are about possible worlds. The word that I use is simulation. They're simulations that enable us to imagine what might happen next. And so the evolutionary question you ask is, would we be better at arranging our lives if we can think ahead and imagine the possible outcomes if this and that and the other thing happened? I think we probably would.
So I have to ask, are you a big fiction reader yourself?
Well, I'm afraid I am, yes. Yes, I apologize.
Well, thank you. This has been great fun.
Well, it's very nice to talk to you, and I'm very interested in the questions you ask.
Keith Oatley is the author of the book Such Stuff as Dreams, The Psychology of Fiction. Now, in a small prison just outside Madison, groups of inmates get together to read and discuss classic novels and poetry and their own writing. They're part of the Oak Hill Prison Humanities Project and the subject of a new documentary called Dostoevsky Behind Bars. It follows the inmates and the University of Wisconsin graduate students who teach them. Naomi Olson led a Russian literature course at the prison, and here's her story.
My name is Naomi Olson, and I'm a PhD candidate in Slavic languages at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I started teaching Russian literature in 2009 at Oak Hill Prison. It's a very different experience from teaching in the university setting. The boundaries between you and your participants have to be firm, and so it's a much greater challenge. You really have to use the text as a way to establish close relationships.
Hands down, I'd want to be with literature. If I learn something today and I learn something tomorrow, then I'm making progress. If I don't learn anything within each day that I'm given, then I'm just, as they say, kicking a dead horse.
Teaching literature in a prison isn't like a Hollywood story where one day you bring in the magical story and someone breaks down and says, oh my God, I now understand. In the beginning, when I would bring in stories, it seemed like the participants' reactions to stories were pretty quick and decisive and resolute. But as time went on, we started to think more carefully about the characters and stop seeing them in terms of good guy or bad guy.
To be able to put both of the stories in perspective and look at it as the third party reading a book, it's like, wow, these type of things unfold like that. So it gives you real life scenarios so that you're able to make better choices in the future.
After I had been teaching for a while, I thought it was time to bring in a text that was a little bit more intense. This is a story called Sleepy by Anton Chekhov, and it tells the tale of a servant girl. And she was entrusted with caring for a baby. But she was so exhausted in the story. She's so tired, and her body is craving sleep so desperately that she unwittingly or unconsciously kills the baby just so that she can sleep. The participants were horrified at the end of the story. But at the same time, we did have empathy for this girl. And I think that what the story did was make us realize that every human circumstance has multiple sides to the story, and it's important to remember that. Life isn't made out of good guys and bad guys. It's always more complicated than that. The role of literature is to expose the ambiguity in our lives and to help us make meaning of the world. I think that the most important human condition is empathy. Without empathy, we're less than human, we're monsters.
In Crime and Punishment, is telling the story of Raskolnikov, this guy who commits a murder, and basically, when he gets sent to prison, it's like a redemption for him. There has been parallels in my life with Raskolnikov. I've used what they've given me in here to become somebody much better than I ever was on the outs. If I get the chance to use that when I get out here, I shall.
If I could make a living teaching literature in a prison, I would. It's so satisfying to be able to have very interesting and thought-provoking conversations in the worst of human circumstances. Throughout most of the day, an inmate only gets to relate to another individual as inmate to inmate or inmate to security officer. And for that 1 hour or 2 hours where we can look at a work of literature, we are all relating to each other as human beings.
That was Naomi Olson talking about the Oak Hill Prison Humanities Project. We also heard from Joshua Hopkins, Daniel Wright, and Scott Jenkins. They're all featured in the new documentary, Dostoevsky Behind Bars. You can check out the trailer on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, does great literature make us more moral? I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, and this hour we're talking about the benefits of reading fiction. We just heard how great literature can make you more empathic, but what about trashy novels? I mean, sometimes I'm just not in the mood for serious fiction. Is there anything to be said for reading mass-market romance or sentimental chick lit?
Even melodrama can carry someone across the gulf between his life and the lives of others. A terrible TV movie about addiction can still make someone feel for the addict, no matter how general this addict, how archetypal or paradigmatic, no matter how trite the plot twists, how shameful the puppetry of heartstrings. Bad movies and bad writing and easy clichés still manage to make us feel things toward each other. Part of me is disgusted by this. Part of me celebrates it.
Leslie Jameson is the author of The Empathy Exams. It's a new collection of essays that explores our basic understanding of others, and in it, she argues for a reappraisal of sentimentality. She talked to producer Sarah Nix about why writers and readers shouldn't be afraid of showing a little emotion.
One of the things that has always moved me as a reader, and so one of the things that I've always wanted to give to readers as a writer, is just intensity of feeling on the page, going deep into characters, their emotional lives, whether those characters exist or don't. And so I think that's always compelled me towards literature. But I also see the ways that when you render emotion wrong or too simply or don't do justice to how complicated and messy it is, you're not honoring it at all. You're sort of doing exactly the opposite. You're flattening it. You're taking emotion from the page. So I think I always feel compelled towards this quest to bring really intense emotional life out in my language and to my readers. But at the same time, I have a lot of fear about what it might mean to do it wrong.
Maybe some examples would be useful here. So what kind of work are you talking about when you're using terms like sentimental or saccharine?
Yeah, I think that what comes to mind for me are, you know, the kind of after school TV special where everything is sort of simple, like the character might be wholly good and everything that happens to them is totally wrong, or you have characters who are villains and other characters who are perfect. And so sadness or happiness, like those emotions have pretty neat edges around them. For me as a writer, I feel like I came of age in an era where there was so much, it was already understood that sentimentality was one of the great evils we were working against. And so part of what I was responding to in the essay that shows up in the book is almost the kind of crippled literature that comes when people are so afraid of being sentimental that they write prose that doesn't have any emotion in it instead. And so that's the kind of peril that lies on the opposite side of the continuum.
Where do you think that came from, that movement away from sentimentality in literature or in fiction in general?
Well, I think some of it came from you know, whatever people mean when they say postmodern, they probably mean a lot of different things, but writing that was very intensely aware of writing as something constructed. So if you put feeling into a piece of writing, like that's just a result of authorial craft. And I think in the second half of the 20th century, there was a real rise and a desire to call attention to everything that writing was doing as it was doing it. And so that was a kind of pushback against sentimentality, and also the kind of rise of irony as one of the languages that we feel most comfortable speaking is very much also kind of pushing back against sentimentality. Hmm.
You know, I was curious when I was reading your Defense of the Saccharine essay, because it wasn't until the final pages when you seemed to get around to explicitly defending sentimentality. Where do you stand on it now?
What I'm really defending is the importance of trying to portray emotion in all senses, in the art that we make, and not being scared off from the portrayal of intense emotion by the fear of being overly sentimental or being called sentimental. Because I think the kind of sentimentality that I'm defending is our right to elicit and experience feelings that are kind of one note, or can be a little bit crude, or can be overly simple and just strong, but that part of our obligation to those feelings is to think through what they mean after we've felt them. And so it's sort of making a case for really intense feeling that's annotated and that's interrogated and that's subjected to certain kinds of questions, you know? So it's like, let's let ourselves move towards these big feelings, but also ask ourselves questions about what's happening as we move towards those big feelings. So it's making a case for that second part of it, that thinking through it part of it.
So you make the case that sentimentality and anti-sentimentality are essentially flip sides of the same coin, that whatever position we take, we're kind of boosting our own egos either way. So what do you think? Should we just give in to the kitsch kind of sentimentality, or let our inner critics, our inner ironics rule? Or is there a middle ground somewhere?
I do think there's a middle ground, because I do believe in trying to represent emotion in complicated, nuanced terms. And so in that sense, I wouldn't wholly side myself with the sentimental if sentimentality is sort of invoking overly simplified emotions. But I also find myself wanting to argue against a lot of anti-sentimental discourse, because so much of how feeling operates, even in these really crude representations, still holds a lot of truth and force to me. And this idea of just simply sort of pushing back against it, that doesn't feel right to me. I want to honor whatever was driving that even overly simplified effusion of feeling. Like, I want to honor that, but I want to ask more of it.
Maybe both sides are just searching for some kind of truth in emotion.
Absolutely. I really feel that that is a part of the quest on both sides.
We should point out, of course, that you also write fiction.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you think there's a difference between empathy, maybe, that we feel in the face of a sentimental fiction, or an emotional response that we have to a great feature story in a newspaper or something like that.
Yeah, I do. And I'm still trying to figure out what the contours of that difference are. But I do think there's a difference. I think some of it has to do with what kind of obligations are entailed by having an emotional response to a story. So in a way, what reading fiction does is give us the satisfaction of feeling like we're empathic, but not demanding anything of us in response, because a character in trouble in a novel isn't out there in the world somewhere actually in trouble. Whereas with nonfiction, you know, when you read a feature in the newspaper about someone suffering in another part of the world or in your own city or wherever it is, there's the possibility and the question of, well, if you have a feeling in response to this story, what are you going to do about it? And what do you owe the person in that story, whether they're in a distant land or in your land? And so I think that that question of whether empathy needs another beat in order to be worthwhile, whether it needs the other beat of action, is differently posed by nonfiction than fiction.
So maybe it's safer for us to have an emotional response to fiction than it is for us to have an emotional response to fact.
Yeah, in a way, it's kind of zero gravity emotional encounter, because you get the feeling without having to pay for it, which is also kind of rhymes with Oscar Wilde's quote on the sentiments. I might be paraphrasing it wrong, but the sentimentalist is one who wants the luxury of a feeling without paying for it, you know, and I think that's some of what we get in fiction.
Hmm. Well, can I ask you to just go out with one more reading?
Yeah, absolutely. The truth is, I resist something in sentimentality, too. I'm afraid of its inflated gestures and broken promises. But I'm just as afraid of what happens when we run away from it. Jadedness, irony, chill. I'm not immune to the siren call of either pole. I've caught myself in all stages of the sentimental guilt-indulgence cycle, clutching tragedy and then fleeing its ramifications, taking refuge in feelings gone molten or frozen in compensation. I'm not the first voice to call for sentimentality in the wake of postmodern irony. There's a chorus. There's been a chorus for years. Once upon a time, it was directed by David Foster Wallace. Now it's directed by his ghost. He was searching for literature that could make our, quote, heads throb heart-like, that could hold feeling and its questioning at once. I believe in the possibility of this heart-like throbbing. I believe in the possibility of Christmas risks. I believe in an interrogated sentimentality that doesn't allow its distortions to be inherited so easily. I want to make a case for the value of that moment when we feel sentimentality punctured, when we feel its flatness revealed, that sense of a vista splitting open or opening out. Something useful happens in that moment of breakage. After the sugar high, always dwells a sharpened sense of everything not sweet. If the saccharine offers some undiluted spell of feeling, oversimplified and unabashedly fictive, then perhaps its value lies in the process of emerging from its thrall, that sense of unmasking, that sense of guilt.
Leslie Jamieson is the author of The Empathy Exams. What do you read when you're not in the mood for serious fiction? Do you have a guilty, sentimental pleasure that you can't quit? Tell us about it on our Facebook page. We've been hearing about how reading literature can help us understand other people, maybe learn to empathize a little more. Does that mean fiction makes us good? Joshua Landy co-directs the Literature and Philosophy Initiative at Stanford, and he's the author of How to Do Things with Fictions. He believes reading literature can be transformative up to a point.
I think it makes you a better person, but it doesn't make you a nicer person. I think it gives you a richer life, and I think it makes you better at all kinds of important mental skills. But I'm rather doubtful that in most cases it makes you more altruistic.
Haven't there been studies, though, connecting, you know, the development of empathy with fiction?
That is a really interesting question. What they've shown is that you get a little bit better at what they call theory of mind, which is reading the mental states of other individuals. But there's actually quite a big gap between that and being nicer to people. These same psychologists have figured out that bullies, for example, have a fairly high capacity for theory of mind. Bullies are very good at figuring out what makes somebody else tick, and that's how they manage to torment them as effectively as they do. So there are various unfortunate lines of behavior that depend on you having a pretty developed sense of what other people are thinking and feeling.
Well, that's very creepy. I guess I would have thought that the experience of reading and getting emotionally invested in a character, it's not just coldly understanding how their mind works. It's an act of active sympathy, active empathy. You get invested in the character, you care about them, maybe you come to love them. That's rather different from just developing a theory of their mind, don't you think?
Well, that's totally true. But again, you just have to look at the data. There have been plenty of people who've had that experience with literature and gone on not necessarily to be very nice people. So Plutarch gives the example of a tyrant, Alexander Phoraeus, who used to weep at tragedies and then go back to having his citizens torn apart by dogs. And, you know, the famous examples are people like Goebbels, who was a big fan of Shakespeare, and my favorite, which is Himmler, who loved Siddhartha, which is Hermann Hesse's Buddhist novel.
So can argue that those are outliers, right? I mean,
yeah,
there are always going to be a few completely pathological human beings.
You can argue that. Suzanne Keene has done a fair amount of research on this. She tells this lovely anecdote of assigning her students in a class books about people in India and Haiti. And she asked the students, you know, how did this change you? And it turns out they called their mothers more.
Well, that's so nice.
It's very nice. But what you get here is basically the influence of in-group bias. So there is absolutely caring for characters and empathizing your way into them. And it may even evoke some kind of warm, fuzzy feeling. But it's very like that warm, fuzzy feeling is going to get directed onto your own in-group.
Well, you could argue that, well, that's baby steps, right? I mean, at least they're becoming somewhat more empathetic towards their in-group.
Right. So that in itself is innocuous. I mean, so that claim would just be, look, let's ratchet down the rhetoric. Literature isn't going to transform everybody from a sinner to a saint. But I think there's a stronger way of putting it, which is very often we like to think that the point of reading works of fiction is for people to change their minds about something. And that, I think, is actually dangerous. People always cite the example of nice books that make people believe nice things. But I think if you encourage people to look to works of fiction to give them guidance as to how to behave, then all kinds of bad results are going to happen. So, for example, I know someone who went to see Edward Albee's play The Goat and concluded from it that bestiality isn't so bad after all.
You're kidding.
Yeah, it's an odd conclusion, but I think it's kind of logical given the way that people are relentlessly told to understand fiction. They're told to extract a message, and if you don't, you're not doing it right.
I mean, I don't see what's wrong with a writer exploring moral or ethical questions, though. I mean, what about, you know, Crime and Punishment, a book that asks very pointed moral questions about crime and guilt?
If you put it that way, then that's exactly the kind of thing literature should be doing and that we as readers should be doing, is exploring questions. But that's very different from, as a writer, trying to change people's minds, or as a reader, just surrendering all critical thinking and giving yourself over to some point of view of an author.
So what do you think of something like, I don't know, George Orwell's 1984?
Well, I don't know what I think about 1984. I mean, there certainly are didactic works out there. And there's room for there to be those works as long as we don't encourage people just to surrender to them and accept whatever they think they're trying to tell them uncritically. I mean, Crime and Punishment's a good example because some people like to say, you know, we learn from Crime and Punishment that crime doesn't pay and you're always going to feel guilty. Would we really learn that? I mean, you could watch Crimes and Misdemeanors, Woody Allen's film, and conclude the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, if you were to base all of your beliefs about the world on works of fiction, you become deeply confused.
Mm. So I take it you wouldn't go the other direction and say that literature exists for nothing but pleasure. It's just a form of entertainment and we should just lose ourselves in wonderful pieces of literature and characters and assume that it has no impact on us at all. So what do we get out of reading great literature?
Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, in fact, one of my pet peeves is the kind of widespread idea that either literature is morally improving or it's just entertainment, which I think is very unfair, very unfortunate. I think there are a bunch of things that we get out of literary works. Some of them help us to feel things, and some of them console us, and some of them give a workout to really important mental skills, and some of them help us to understand who we are.
So a book can kind of break open feelings in us that we may have not been able to access. I guess I would have said there's something moral about that.
Well, I mean, you know, what I want to say is basically what they say on those, you know, those drug disclaimers. Results may vary. Right? So mm-hmm. you may unlock your emotions and that may make you a nicer person, and I may unlock my emotions and maybe that will make me a slightly less altruistic person. It's really unpredictable. But what you can say is it's going to give you a richer life.
So what do you say to students who, I mean, you teach French literature, some of which is not necessarily the easiest or most fun stuff to read. I mean, you know, plowing through Beckett or even Proust. All those volumes of Proust.
Yes.
So why bother?
I think for the reasons I was saying, that there's really no substitute for an engagement with a truly extraordinary work of literature to get to grips with who it is that you are and what it is you really care about. And there's no substitute for exercising certain mental skills, certain tricks of mind that you can only really fine-tune by means of literary works.
Yeah, Joshua, I just read a survey in Great Britain. 63% of the men surveyed said they don't read books, or at least not many. What do you think the consequences might be for a society that stops reading fiction?
Well, all predictions are wrong, so I hesitate to predict, but I do think we're going to lose out on a certain set of opportunities, opportunities for self-understanding, opportunities for the cultivation of certain ways of thinking, habits of mind, possibly even opportunities for encountering our own feelings and, yeah, taking the axe to the frozen sea within us. Some of those things can certainly be satisfied by film and television, but I think there are going to be some things that are lost. And I think maybe something like a certain kind of patience, a certain willingness to set foot in an experience that's going to take you days, maybe weeks.
Joshua, thanks for talking. This was great.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Joshua Landy is the co-director of the Literature and Philosophy Initiative at Stanford, and he's the author of the book, How to Do Things with Fictions. That wraps up our discussion on whether fiction makes us good. When we come back, producers Sarah Nix and Charles Monroe Kane have a couple of literary films to recommend, and we'll wish William Shakespeare a happy 450th birthday. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, watch this. Sarah Nix and Charles Monroe Kane catch us up on documentaries just released for streaming.
Hey, Charles.
Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Good. What did you watch this week?
I watched Salinger, this interesting documentary, of course, about J.D. Salinger. And it was such a bizarre thing to watch because on one hand, you're watching a biopic of probably the greatest American writer, him and Hemingway, right? But you also know in the back of your head the whole time you're watching it, this guy wants to be left alone. He does not want this biopic to be made. He doesn't want people to meet him, talk about him.
They make that clear in the film?
Very clear in the film. But at the same time, they're invading his privacy by making the film. We have a clip about that that I think helps articulate that.
So it's 1979. I get an assignment from Newsweek magazine to photograph this author.
He doesn't like to be photographed, but we do know he picks up his mail in Windsor, Vermont. So I waited.
And then this Jeep pulls up, and he gets out, and he goes into the post office really quickly. And then as it came back out, I got it. I got Salinger.
It was weird to watch it for that reason. But then again, at the same time, I want to know more about him. And I learned so much. I'm going to reread the book now because of this. But I was left feeling a little dirty that I invaded his privacy because he's very clearly wants to be left alone.
Well, I also watched a literary-themed kind of program. It's actually part of a six-hour series. It's a BBC production. It's airing on PBS right now. And it's called Shakespeare Uncovered. I watched it in part because it's the 450th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth, as we know. I watched the hour about Hamlet, which is hosted by British actor David Tennant, who was in a Royal Shakespeare Company production of the play. And it's kind of fun. We get to see some context. We go to the school that Shakespeare probably attended, and he talks with historians about things like what Elizabethan audiences would have thought about the ghost in the play. The most interesting part, though, for me, was his conversation with other actors who've tried to tackle the role. And here are a few, starting with Jude Law.
We know that this particular role is also like a sharing of one's soul. So it's like you're not just going to see your preferred actor, but you're also going to see them perhaps bearing a side of themselves and revealing a side of themselves that's really intimate.
I think of all the parts I've played, that one feels the most transparent. When you go and see it, you're seeing something very personal, private about the actor who's playing it.
Something extraordinary about stripping away your acting persona, really. I think in the end, you're standing on stage as David Tennant. Mm.
And there's this great moment in the Shakespeare documentary where David Tennant is standing at the Royal Shakespeare Company's gift shop, pulling all of these film versions of Hamlet off the shelf. So it's worth watching if you want a little literature in amongst your documentaries.
That was Sarah Nix and Charles Monroe Kane with Watch This. You can see trailers of the documentaries they talked about on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week we're celebrating William Shakespeare's legacy on the 450th anniversary of his birth. Shakespeare's contributions to the English language may not come as a surprise to many people, but the Bard's influence extends to areas you may not even have considered. Take, for instance, starlings or Lincoln's assassination. Stephen Marsh is the author of How Shakespeare Changed Everything, and he told me why he thinks Shakespeare is the most important figure in Western history.
What happened is that very quickly, as I began to research, I saw that his influence was really everywhere. I mean, it was in the sky, it was in politics, it was in the assassination of Lincoln, it was in our categories of sex, categories of race, thinking about things as fundamental as adolescence. The title seems crazy, you know, How Shakespeare Changed Everything, but in fact, I really didn't feel that there was any other title I could give it. You know, I did have some really quite lovely and nice priests write me and say, you know, I quite like your book, but Jesus was much more influential. And we had a sort of lively debate about it. But I guess to me, I don't see any evidence that Jesus actually had a big impact on the world, whereas Shakespeare, I find evidence for him pretty much everywhere.
Or at least in our daily lives.
Yeah, exactly. In everything, in the shoes we buy and, you know, in the birds in the sky.
Wow. Well, we should start simply by talking about language, because I know Shakespeare
yes.
had a huge influence on the English language, and we all make constant Shakespearean quotations, I think, often without even realizing that we're quoting Shakespeare. But I didn't know until reading your book that Shakespeare was a kind of master coiner of words.
He was absolutely the master coiner of words. Virginia Woolf said he came out of the ocean of language dripping with new words. Nobody really knows where words originate. I mean, even contemporary words where we have good records. I mean, nobody knows who really came up with the first word computer, say. But Shakespeare is the first usage in the Oxford English Dictionary for 1,700 words, which is shocking. No other author in any other language, certainly not in English, comes anywhere close.
And 1,700. I'm just trying to wrap my mind. 1,700.
It's mind-boggling.
Practically created a language.
Well, I believe that the actual total number of words in Shakespeare is 36,000. So if you think about it, like 1,700 out of 36,000 words in his entire opus are new. So it's like a good portion of his language is actually new words.
What are some of them?
Well, it's things as ordinary as like eyeball, farmhouse. You know, he did things like he took foreign words and gave them their English forms, like bandito in Italian becomes bandit. Now, that may not seem very huge, but it's actually a major leap to go from bandito to bandit. Things as simple as gnarled, hobnobbed, gossip. I mean, alligator, academe, words like zany, kickshaw. Words, you know, some fancy words like consanguineous. You know, this includes also words like where he took the word assassin and made it assassination. So he's the first usage of assassination. Advertising. I mean, words you would never think of. Like, he invented the word skim milk. The first usage of skim milk is in Shakespeare. I know. And advertising, too.
The point you make in your book is that Shakespeare's influence goes far beyond just language.
Mm-hmm.
You write about Shakespeare's influence on even nature in that there's this remarkable thing you say that it's thanks to Shakespeare we have starlings in North America.
Yes, or well, one of his fans, more specifically, a man named Eugene Shiflin, who was a pharmaceutical manufacturer in the 1890s in New York. His plan was to introduce every bird mentioned in Shakespeare to the New World. And so what he did was, and he did a bunch of them, but the only one that stuck was the starlings. He brought them 60 pairs he imported from Europe, and he released them into Central Park. And now there are 200 million in North America. They're incredibly devastating. They have a fruit costs more because of them. They're a real problem for orchard keepers. They've gone all the way from the Gulf of Mexico to the Arctic Circle. You know, literally, the prairies of North America would be full of bluebirds if not for a single line in Henry IV, Part 1, which is the only place where starlings are mentioned. So he does have this incredible, you know, these chains of consequence that sort of radiate out of him. That, I mean, not that he could ever have imagined them, but they do sort of radiate out from his work in a totally unique way.
Mm. Sometimes in creepy ways. What was the, there's a connection between Abraham Lincoln's assassination and Shakespeare.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those connections that seems impossible and yet is, you know, it, he just props up so prominently in the story. You know, John Wilkes Booth, he was an actor, and he was the son of Lucius Brutus Booth, who was the greatest actor of his generation in America. And he was the brother of Edwin Booth, who was the greatest actor of his generation and did the most, you know, the longest running Hamlet on Broadway up to that point and was a truly great actor. What happened was, you know, they could make a living performing as the Booth brothers, but they had to take different territories. So Edwin took the Northeast and John Wilkes took the South and the other brother took the West. And then because of that Southern affiliation, John Wilkes, you know, became this sort of Southern partisan. And about 6 months before he shot Lincoln, he starred in Julius Caesar. When he goes to assassinate Lincoln, it's very much modeled on the assassination of Julius Caesar. First of all, he shoots him in a theater. When he shoots him, he jumps on the stage after shooting him and shouts, "Sic semper tyrannis." He speaks in Latin, just as Julius Caesar at the moment of his death speaks in Latin. He explicitly calls on this version of republicanism that is heroically portrayed in the play. And when he's on the run from the feds after shooting Lincoln, he explicitly in his diaries, he says, you know, "I'm being hounded over hill and dale for doing what Brutus was honored for." So he very clearly had Brutus and that play very much in mind.
So it sounds like it was really a kind of Shakespearean assassination.
I mean, I say in the book that it was in a sense an assassination written by Shakespeare. I mean, and there's other weird coincidences too. Like on the day before he was shot, Lincoln was going up the Potomac in a steamship with Charles Sumner, Senator Charles Sumner, and he was reciting passages from Macbeth as he was going up the river to his death. And Macbeth is the play where the word assassination is first coined. I mean, it's really—
This is bizarre.
You see, I know. Well, this is the thing. This is why the book is called How Shakespeare Changed Everything, because he keeps showing up in these incredibly weird ways.
Like a deus ex machina.
Yeah, it was just really like, oh my goodness, there he is again. You know, like a sort of Zelig figure in history. And I mean, even the book's been called Bardolatry in several ways. And obviously Shakespeare was a genius, but I mean, there are a lot of great writers out there. I mean, there's Dante and there's Joyce and but they don't show up in history in the same way. Not at all.
You also draw a line between Barack Obama and Shakespeare, specifically Shakespeare's play Othello.
Yeah, I mean, Othello has this amazing effect on American history. I mean, this was another thing that was just incredibly surprising to me. I mean, it's always been a very popular play. It was particularly a very popular play in antebellum South, where white actors would do it in sort of very light tones on, you know, the Bronze Age of Othello, as it was called. But then Paul Robeson, the great African-American actor, he was the sort of first person to do a black Othello by a black man, other than Ira Aldridge, who had to leave America to do it and did it in Europe quite successfully in the 1850s. But when Robeson does it, I mean, he says, "Othello has set me free."
In what way did Robeson think it had set him free then?
Well, he was able to create this space with Othello where he was a sort of, because there's no doubting that Othello is noble. There's no doubting that Othello is noble and also that his love for Desdemona, his love for this white woman is legitimate. And those two facts, a strong, eloquent black man and a black man legitimately sleeping with a white woman in 1940s America were so intense. Like they had such a profound reaction. I mean, he became the most popular Shakespeare actor on Broadway in history. It made him the most famous African-American in the world by a long measure, gave him unprecedented political heft. I mean, he managed to get sort of his choice for a communist counselor in Harlem elected. He was the first African-American to speak to Major League Baseball on the subject of desegregation. Robeson definitely paved the way for the social activism of the civil rights movement 20 years later.
Are you suggesting that some of Robeson's stature as a public figure came from his having played Othello and from the kind of legitimacy that the character of Othello gave him?
Absolutely. And it gave, and he used it to explicitly, you know, plead for his people.
So there's a way in which you can say that Shakespeare had something to do with the integration of American society.
Absolutely. Absolutely you can. I mean, I would say that Robeson was the prototype of figures like Martin Luther King and prototype of figures like Obama. I mean, these real, like, breaking down the doors of, you know, white America and forcing them to see eloquent, strong black men. You know, he and Othello gave him the means to do that. You know, I mean, obviously that's not the whole story, but, you know, it is a big part of that story. It's much like the assassination of Lincoln. You know, it's just Shakespeare shows up at these key moments with really surprising amount of power.
Stephen March is the author of How Shakespeare Changed Everything. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced today's show, with help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Stephanie Youngblood. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director, Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strain Champs. Thanks for spending time with us today.
PRI, Public Radio International.